Good afternoon and welcome to Speaking Truth to Empire on KFCF 88.1 FM Free Speech Radio for Central California. My name is Dan Yassin and I'm an anti-war and anti-empire activist. Mike Rhodes is at the control. Today is June 21st, 2017, third Wednesday of the month. Every third Wednesday from 3 to 3:30 p.m., I interview authors, bloggers, columnists, and activists who help us look at our world through the prism of American imperialism. On the show, we talk about U.S. foreign and domestic policies and the actions of the military-industrial surveillance congressional complex. These actions have severe consequences not just for the people in the U.S., but people in many other countries. To create a better, humane, and a compassionate world, we must first understand what is being done in our name, and we must always be willing to stand up, speak out, and speak truth to empire. Today we have Norman Solomon on telephone with us. Hello, Norman.
Hi, Dan.
Thank you for being my guest on Speaking Truth to Empire.
Sure.
Norman Solomon is an author, journalist, media critic, and an anti-war activist. Solomon is a longtime associate of the media watch group FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. He is the coordinator of the online activist group RootsAction.org and the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. He is the author of a dozen books, including War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. He has appeared as a guest on many media outlets, including the PBS, CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, C-SPAN, KPFA, and NPR. Norman, in an article titled How the Russia Spin Got So Much Torque, you described how this Blame Russia thing started within 24 hours of Hillary's concession speech. Describe it for our audience.
Yes, we're talking about in the second week of November, Hillary Clinton had just been declared the loser of the presidential race against Donald Trump. And according to a book by two journalists who were embedded with the campaign, a book titled Shattered, there was a high-level meeting of top Hillary Clinton campaign officials at the national headquarters of the Hillary Clinton for President campaign in Brooklyn. So we're talking, Dan, just 24 hours after the polls closed, and they decided to blame the defeat largely on Russia. And I think it's important for us to understand that the wave of publicity and claims and accusations and media frenzy didn't come from nowhere. It's been a process and a priority by the losing side to focus on Russia issues as having been key to the defeat. The intervention, we're told, by Russian government hackers and so forth, those associated with the Russian government. And I want to be clear, Dan, that I think it's quite possible that there was some hacking. I think it's quite probable that some Russian intrusions took place into the election campaign emails and so forth of the Clinton campaign. I think that it's important to note that these kind of things happen a lot, and anybody with, I think, a reasonably sophisticated understanding of the U.S. government would understand that it does probes of Soviet, or rather now these days Russian, government and other emails and databases in Russia. So what I think I would just close on my response on this point is that the ranking Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee said earlier this month, Senator Mark Warner of Virginia, that there's no evidence that a single vote was changed in the tabulation of the election here in the United States due to any hacking coming from Russia. So I think we should bear that in mind.
In the same article, you talk about something called Moscow Project. Tell us about that.
Yes, the Moscow Project is something that was launched a couple of months ago with a lot of funding by the Center for American Progress, which has John Podesta, the top Clinton campaign official and longtime Clinton high-level operative, on the board of directors. And it's run by people who avowedly are longtime dedicated supporters of Bill and Hillary Clinton. And they've put in a lot of money, not only for the website called the Moscow Project, but with their media outreach and really prodigious capacity to generate op-ed articles and get guests on network TV and all the rest of it, to crowdsource and search for any kinds of information, purported information, allegations, speculations masquerading as information that Russia had a huge effect on the U.S. election. And so that's a well-heeled effort from the Center for American Progress. And I think more broadly, Dan, it's important to note that we got a tremendous amount of push from what's called the intelligence community to back up these claims. And on January 6th of this year, there was a report from then Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, which involved a 25-page document, and it was widely derided by many independent journalists, such as the former Newsweek and AP reporter Robert Perry, now at ConsortiumNews.com, as extremely thin. Now, they cut and pasted a two-year-old report about RT, the Russian-owned network with RT America in the United States, 2 years old, and they put it in this report to try to show the tremendous effect, purportedly, that RT had on the U.S. election in terms of propaganda. Very few people in the U.S. even watch it. A lot of the references were very outdated, and it's just sort of a metaphor for how shoddy and thin that report was.
DNC emails were leaked and published by WikiLeaks in July of 2016. John Podesta's emails were published in October. And as we discuss, Hillary's team started blaming Russia for her defeat after the election in November. Many Democrats and progressives believe that Russia did interfere in our election. And as you had mentioned, the intelligence agencies, and they've been looking on these things for close to, 10 months, 11 months. Why has there been no evidence found?
Well, you know, to some people, there is a lot of evidence found, but I think those who take a clear view of it have to assume, if they believe there's solid evidence, that they're going to give the benefit of all doubts to the CIA and the National Security Agency of the United States and so forth. And these documents, when they're really subjected to scrutiny, they involve subjective analysis, and there's really a lack of hard evidence. But we're in a political climate where so much hostility has been drummed up about Russia that there are a lot of people who, for various reasons, including that Donald Trump is such an awful president, and he is a very dangerous, awful president, they're looking for explanations. And it's much easier and politically advantageous, by the way, to blame Russia than, for instance, to blame James Comey, the director of the FBI, who had, even as Hillary Clinton has acknowledged, a very damaging effect by announcing a reopening of the investigation into Hillary Clinton's email servers, a whole different set of email issues, about 11 days before Election Day in the U.S. Well, I would ask people listening here to KFCF, if you are the Democratic Party hierarchy, if you're Hillary Clinton for that matter, would you rather polarize with the FBI Director James Comey in 2017, or would you rather polarize with Vladimir Putin? And so I think what we've seen is sort of a dredging up and revving up of hostility towards Russia. And it's very dangerous because between the United States and Russia, Those two countries have 93% of the nuclear weapons in the world. And if you look at just the encounters over Syria in the last couple of days, aircraft from from the U.S., from shooting down a Syrian government plane, which is a Syrian government, of course, closely aligned with Russia, we're told that there was I think it was over the Baltics, within just a few feet, Russian and U.S. planes. This is extremely dangerous to be revving up this sort of hostility.
You wrote in another article about how with dutiful conformity, most Democrats in Congress and the party elites have jumped on the bandwagon of blame Russia. The party establishment wants to continue and take it to 2018 and 2020 elections. So that's what their strategy is. They think they can. This could be a winning strategy for them. Tell us about what your analysis of it is.
Well, there is a belief that that's a winning strategy. Of course, Hillary Clinton ran partly against Russia in the closing months of her presidential campaign last year. You can see how that turned out, whether we're talking about people in western Pennsylvania or Michigan or Wisconsin or in the Central Valley here in California. Do you think the people you know who are under economic stress are more worried about their economic stress or worried about the Kremlin? And this is something that I think we need to take a hard look at. If we're going to defeat this horrible right-wing Republican juggernaut in Congress, in Washington in general, do we really think that even if we leave aside, which we shouldn't, the dangers of touching off a conflict with Russia that could go into a nuclear holocaust, do we really think it's an effective tactic to keep talking about Russia so that the U.S. Democratic Party is more associated with hostility to Russia than trying to help people in economic difficulty in the United States? And I think this is a sort of a focus that points up the problem that we have here.
You're listening to Speaking Truth to Empire on KFCF 88.1 FM Free Speech Radio for Central California. We are speaking with Norman Solomon, an author, journalist, media critic, and an anti-war activist. Norman, last week, U.S. Senate voted 98-2 to impose new sanctions on Russia. Many people believe imposing sanctions is an act of war. What is your take on this?
Well, I don't know if they're an act of war. I mean, sometimes you need to impose sanctions on. I wish that the Reagan administration had imposed sanctions on the racist regime of South Africa. To go overboard and be doing all sorts of self-righteous sanctions, I mean, I'll just put it this way. The U.S. not only has no sanctions against Saudi Arabia, but is selling billions and billions of dollars of aircraft as Saudi Arabia slaughters people in Yemen. So how to justify doing the opposite of sanctions for Saudi Arabia, which is a far more repressive regime than Russia, and then turn around and say we've not only got sanctions on Russia, but we need to increase them? I think it's preposterous, and yet this is where we are. I understand the House of Representatives now has held up the sanctions bill on a sort of a technicality, so it's unclear whether they will sail through the House. I suspect procedurally there will be some adjustments, and there will be that taking place. And this is, again, where a lot of people have been baiting Trump that he isn't tough enough on Russia. Well, that increases the chances he will be stampeded into signing these sanctions, which is, I think, all around a bad idea.
Well, one of the reasons I thought was that because in his rhetoric, or at least the campaign rhetoric, he talked about having good relations with Russia, and this is putting pressure on Trump. So he doesn't do that, but since right. He already did fire those 59 cruise missiles on Syria, so he's already getting in line to do that anyway.
Yeah. Well, no doubt that pressure is having a political effect.
Yes.
And it's very dangerous.
It is. Some people believe that anti-Russia and anti-Putin hysteria now is worse than the anti-Soviet and anti-communism hysteria at the height of the Cold War. Do you agree, or what is your opinion on that?
Well, I haven't been in Russia for 30 years, but I understand that the anti-American feeling in Russia is worse than it was during the height of the Cold War. I think that's not only because of the propaganda barrage of the last couple of years, but also because of the economic ravaging of shock therapy imposed largely by the U.S. in the 1990s after the fall of the Soviet Union. In the U.S., it's gotten pretty bad. It's gotten pretty dangerous.
You had already mentioned that the U.S. Navy plan shot down a Syrian army jet just this last Sunday, and it was in violation of the mutual deconflict agreement that Russia and U.S. have. And Russian reaction was swift. They decided that they are going to abandon the deconflict agreement, and they have threatened to track and intercept U.S. aircraft. And some have described this as a Sarajevo moment. What do you think?
Well, it's a scary moment. It's a very dangerous moment where a lot of the anti-Russia hysteria is having an effect. And we've got to realize what's at stake here. There's a lot of propaganda flying around. People just think it's some sort of a tactical move that makes sense. In fact, it could be leading a chain reaction that is horrible. And so I urge people to contact members of the Congress and let them know you want them to stop just beating up rhetorically on Russia. We're going to have to get along or we'll blow each other up.
Just before the Iraq War, 69% of Americans believed that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. And now here we are. We have a similar situation. 68% of Americans believed that there was collusion between Trump and Russia. Are we sleepwalking towards a World War III, which could easily turn into a nuclear war, as you mentioned earlier?
Well, it's quite possible. You know, it's interesting you mentioned that, Dan, because FAIR, the Media Watch group, just put out a statement in the last hour here MSNBC had an interview that seemed to be pushing for a confrontation with Russia, even if that involves World War III. Now, this is not a right-wing outlet, MSNBC. It's very centrist at this point. But that's where some of this momentum is going, and if people might want to read about that on the web at fair.org.
Okay, in your recent article, you described, you have mentioned him a couple of times, how a promising new progressive congressman, James Reskin, is towing the party line. And you also describe how Robert Reich used the time-worn technique. I cannot prove it's true, but let's proceed as though it is. Tell us about those two scenarios in that article that you had written.
Yeah, well, those are a couple of examples. One, a member of Congress, another, former labor secretary in the Clinton administration, both of them considered quite progressive. Jamie Raskin was a very good progressive member of the Maryland General Assembly, Maryland Senate in the state legislature, and with great encouragement for progressives, he was elected to Congress from Maryland last November. So he took office in January and immediately began a kind of frenzied, I would say virtually unhinged, verbal barrage against Russia that you would expect from, you know, back in the 60s, Barry Goldwater. You would expect perhaps from Lindsey Graham or John McCain. But this is from a very progressive, ostensibly, member of Congress, saying things that were just preposterous, connecting Syria and Venezuela and other countries and the Philippines as all tied in with what he called in a speech a couple of weeks ago the ringmaster of the unfree world, Vladimir Putin. And so I wrote about that in the piece, which is you can most easily find it on my website, normansalmon.com. And likewise, Robert Reich, who was not that extreme, but still I cite where without evidence he used this, I would say, propaganda technique. I'm not saying it's true, but let's suppose it's true, and then going ahead in his piece and saying, well, I didn't say it's true, but I'm saying it's true. And it's all this sort of speculation about how the Trump campaign, Trump himself directly colluded with Vladimir Putin. I mean, this is the kind of thing, as I say in my article, that when the shoe's on the other foot and the right wing uses such techniques, when Fox News uses such techniques, and they do, progressives find absolutely abhorrent. So why should we turn around and say, oh, not only is it fine, but we're going to do that kind of thing ourselves? It's not just that progressives don't want to be attacked. It's also that progressives generally don't want to have a political environment where deception and demagoguery prevail. And that's the kind of standard that we need to try to adhere to. We're not going to engage in demagoguery. We're going to condemn it because we want true public debate, not based on smears.
In the article, the same article that we talked about earlier, you described and talked about Moscow Project, you had this to say, and I quote, along the way, no outlet has been more in sync than MSNBC, and no one on the network has been more promotional of the Russian-run Trump meme than Rachel Maddow, tirelessly promoting the line and sometimes connecting dots in Glenn Beck fashion to the point of journalistic malpractice. I guess we can assume that she has drunk what you described somewhere, the Clinton Kremlin Kool-Aid. What do you have to add for that?
Yeah, you know, quite often in politics, Dan, we're encouraged to say, oh, this person, good, 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 this person, bad, bad, bad. And I think we need a much more nuanced understanding, really, of how people in public life and people in general often function. Rachel Maddow has done very good journalism on a lot of topics. On Russia, since November, she has been horrible. She has been like Glenn Beck. She has been, without evidence or by distorting what little dots she can provide, providing a picture that is absolutely demagogic. And her claims to know what happened, her claims against Russia, are often, I would argue, preposterous. They're not journalism. They're polemics with an almost unhinged relationship to actual facts. And it's not just that it's bad journalism, as we've been saying, as I've been really asserting here. It's very dangerous. And yes, it's proved very good for her ratings, and there's a base that hates Trump and therefore, unfortunately, thinks that they should grasp onto this very thinly sourced and often fanciful storyline about Russia. And Rachel Maddow seems to have her own priorities. Well, we've got to have our own priorities to raise these issues and have the same standards for all sorts of media.
Norman, in my opinion, geopolitically speaking, the world is moving towards a multipolar world, and both neocons and neoliberals who have been in charge, in control of the U.S. and the unipolar world, are not ready to accept the changing reality. What do you think?
Well, I basically agree. You know, when the Soviet Union fell, there was a lot of triumphalism from people like, oh, Charles Krauthammer, many pundits who said, yay, now we have a unipolar world. They thought that was great. You know, the U.S. very benevolently will be astride the globe like a colossus. It's all going to be terrific. But that was not very realistic. It's not only about Russia. It's about China and Brazil and India, other countries that are economically growing, that are populous, that will not simply cede to the U.S. the dominance, the imperial dominance of their country or their region. And as you mentioned, a lot of nationalists don't like that in the United States. They think it's the 21st century should be an American century, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, there are corporate interests, which are multinational, but so often based and rooted in the United States. And it is a corporate view of the world. And if the U.S. Can help dominate, great. There's that statement in Thomas Friedman's book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, where he said, to have McDonald's around the world, you need McDonnell Douglas, the military plane weapons manufacturer. So he thought that was a good thing. And I think that's an outlook. And so you've been in different parts of the world, and so have I. People in many parts of the world just do not accept the idea that the U.S. should dominate.
And that's where, like I said, the problem lies. Okay, you have written a couple of articles, and I know you were a supporter of Bernie, and one of the articles on this topic you had written about the Democratic Party's anti-Bernie elites have a huge stake in blaming Russia. Connect that to us.
Yes, because after the election in November, there was a lot of talk in the media among progressives, among Democrats. Gee, how did Hillary Clinton try to claim she was on the side of the people when she was so enmeshed in Wall Street? And it was really an opportunity. Many people were saying, well, gee, you can't pretend to be progressively on the side of the people when you're so entwined with the big banks, with the huge corporations, with Wall Street in general. And that was an important effort for self-examination. But the subject was largely changed away from that in terms of interpreting reasons for her loss to blaming Russia. And so it's been tremendously helpful to the Clinton wing of the party to focus on Russia as a key villain in the election storyline. And therefore, it's been a good tool for them to divert attention or momentum away from the very valid points that Bernie Sanders and millions of supporters have adhered to, which is that you do not want Wall Street to be able to focus in that way their power on our political system through the Democratic Party.
If you have less than a minute to just tell us about this recent shooting on the baseball practice of Republican and how the New York Times article and the right-wing media is blaming it on Bernie Sanders.
Well, I deconstruct that on my website in my latest article. People can go to normansolomon.com. And I basically talk about how there was a strong tendency in a lot of media, including the New York Times, to try to pin it in some bizarre way on Bernie Sanders and his constituency. And it just goes to show you how powerful propaganda can be.
Thank you, Norman, for being my guest on the show. Until next time.
Thank you, Dan.
You have been listening to Speaking Truth to Empire on KFCF 88.1 FM Free Speech Radio for Central California. We were speaking with Norman Solomon, an author, journalist, media critic, and an anti-war activist. My name is Dan Yassin, host of the show. Thank you for listening. I'll be back third Wednesday of next month. Goodbye.